This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security, backed by HM Treasury.
Have you seen OS?
Sorry?
OS. Seen it.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me in the studio is editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss to round up the week's top stories they've been covering on their award-winning website. And it is housing madness this week. Mother's tired, she needs a rest, the kids are playing up downstairs. Adam Squibb, or a fix for the broken housing market?
We have now priced people out of owner occupation. People are in some places spending half or two-thirds of their disposable income on insecure renting.
You know, we were promised a white paper. Say the critics, what we got was a white flag. The team will run the rule over the government's plans. All the more relevant as we're being warned to brace ourselves for another half a century of rising rents and house prices. Not everyone is convinced by the forecast, though.
The headlines predicated around this being a little bit alarmist. If rents increase by 3 to 4% per annum, that's not particularly scary.
Well, elsewhere, Npower mounts a strong bid for a record 8th successive worst customer satisfaction title as it hikes energy prices almost 10%. Better news for those on prepayment meters with a cap coming in, but does it go far enough?
There's little choice in that market, and they are the people that need the choice and be able to shop around for the prices, perhaps more than the people that just pay the direct debit.
And there's plenty of good news if you fancy a new motor as dealers fall over themselves to get you through the doors. But something's got Simon's goat, and yeah, it's fresh from his trip to the Royal Mint. We follow Lee Charlie Bucket Boyce as he heads off on his latest adventure. But where did he visit this time? Did he get the golden ticket or a bad egg? We'll go live to This Is Money HQ, because Lee's already been allowed out once this week already, to find out. So on that theme, I've been asking today, your most memorable school trips. A very good morning, Simon. A very good morning, Rachel.
Morning.
Rachel, I'm going to come to you first, if that's all right. A memorable school trip for you.
My most memorable, the one that I wasn't supposed to be on. It's something that we still haven't quite reconciled in our family. My sister went at the age of, what, probably about 14, when it really matters that you are or are not cool, on a school trip skiing. First time she'd been skiing. And my mum and I thought, wouldn't it be funny if we turned up?
No.
So we did. We hadn't skied before either, so we thought, let's just go for it. And we went and we stayed on the other side of the mountain. But one day, towards the end of the week, when we had sufficient skills to do it, we skied over to the other side. And when we spotted her, we said, Annie, Annie. She did not acknowledge us. And to this day, we can't really talk about it yet.
That is so mean. Are you an older or a younger sister?
Older sister.
Oh, that's
of
even worse. Did she get her own back? She's still trying to think of one.
I'm sure in various ways.
Simon, for you?
That is very, very funny. Nothing that funny. I was casting my mind back. I can't remember going on that many sort of major school trips, but the one thing that was great was our school had a remote farmhouse in Wales, which it had sort of turned into a place for the kids to go for a week, you know, and you could do outdoor stuff. And there was a couple of dorm rooms and it was surrounded by forest and it was up a hillside. And it was brilliant. It was the most fun that, you know, you could possibly have. And we went for a week, I think, in our first year of school when we were 11. We obviously got taken on walks and things like that, but we did other stuff like canoeing and things, went to the beach and stuff like that. But some of the best times were when we were just left alone, just to sort of wander around the countryside.
And then your brother and your mum turn up.
A gang of 11-year-old boys. Yeah, no, my family did not turn up and surprise me.
John, for me, it was memorable. When I say memorable, it doesn't have to be a good thing. For me, we were sold this trip to Iceland. Not a cheap one, I'd like to point out. We whale watch, skidoo driving, we'd walk on glaciers. All really amazing. Had we actually done any of those things rather than spend 95% of the time on a coach? Rubbish.
On
digital radio across the UK and online. This is Share Radio.
Talking of rubbish, a damp squib with little hopes of fixing anything, feeble beyond belief. We were promised a white paper, we got a white flag. Just some of the criticism directed this week at the government's plans to fix the broken housing market.
The problem is, if you read the ministerial statement today and the white paper, you will not find any reference to their commitment to build a million net new homes by 2020, nor is there a commitment in the white paper to putting in the money which will actually deliver the total number of homes which they want to be between 225,000 and 275,000 a year over the next few years. So there's an aspiration in the government's white paper, but the reality is that this white paper is not going to deliver it.
Liberal Democrat Shadow Housing Minister Lord John Shipley there. Even Community Secretary Sajid Javid said owning a home was a distant dream for millions. So whether you're a landlord, first-time buyer, renter or would-be downsizer, we're going to be taking a look at how the government's housing white paper plans affect you. But before we look at the fine details, Simon, first of all, is this a housing crisis or hyperbole and rhetoric?
Well, no, it is a crisis because fundamentally putting a roof over your head is one of life's essentials. And if putting a roof over your head is so expensive that it hampers you from doing other things in other parts of your life, then it is a genuine problem. And it's a problem that I think cuts through the whole of society. This is a problem for people who are low earners, and it is a problem for people who are high earners. Mm. Now, the problem that the high earners have is a wonderful problem for the low earners to aspire to. But still, you know, the fact that there are high earners in this country who live in properties that they consider too small for themselves or are smaller than they aspire to, and so they spend a disproportionate amount of their time, effort and money just trying to live in that property, is kind of as much of a problem as it is for low earners, to be honest, because the overall issue is it stops people from doing other things in their lives. It stops people from moving jobs. It stops people from taking entrepreneurial risks. It stops people from living their lives in the way that they want to. And yes, houses are more expensive in the south of the country than they are in the north of the country and all these other things. But what you need to do is you need to compare the cost of a house to the money that people earn and the money that people earn in those areas. And I have in front of me a report that came from the ONS last year, which shows that basically house prices in 122 local authorities are 10 times the local median earnings. And I have a map that has been compiled here, and a credit to The Guardian, because this is from The Guardian. It shows most of the country, house prices to wages are 5 to 9.9, basically. Then massive chunks of the country is 10 to 14.9. And then other bits, the most expensive bits, is 15 to 19.9. So times the local wage. And there are some teeny tiny pockets where house prices are 3.9 to 4.9 times wages. So there are basically some teeny tiny pockets of the UK where house prices are about as expensive as they should be. And the whole of the rest of the UK, they are far more expensive than they should be. And we haven't even touched upon the bit where rent eats a huge amount of people's wages yet.
We'll get there. But, Rachel, over the last three decades, governments of all stripes, haven't they, have promised radical change to solve England's housing crisis. Problem is, though, a lot of the initiatives outlined in the white paper and the ideas that are sold to us, are they just a sort of business as usual?
This report was 104 pages long. And I have to say, Sarah Davidson...
That's quite short for one of these sorts of things, isn't it?
It's long for the amount of content in
right.
it. So Sarah Davidson, a mortgage expert, and Mario Butterworth, who's our property expert, were very excited about this white paper because it was supposed to have some sort of things in it that may make a difference to the general landscape. Had nothing. Mm-hmm. A lot of it was, oh, could we please remind you of this thing that we announced 6 months ago or that we've been doing for the past 2 years? So they talked about Help to Buy, support for renters to make sure they're not being ripped off so much by agents. But in terms of substance, there's nothing in it that will make a considerable difference. No real pledges on house building. It's just a reiteration of all sorts of other little things and tweaks here and there.
Yeah. My favourite was cutting red tape on planning, which as part of the plan seems to be to get local authorities to come up with a plan by 2018. So yeah, our plan is to make you come up with a plan, but not yet. What sort of an idea is that?
Well, look, I think that building more houses would obviously help. I'm not going to deny that we don't need to build more houses in this country, because we've been building too few houses for a long time. However, there are two fundamental issues that are causing the problem of high house prices, and building a million homes is probably only going to put a relatively small dent in the problem. And the two fundamental issues are interest rates are really, really low. Money is cheap. Basically, the thing that enables people to afford these ridiculously overpriced houses compared to their wages is the fact that they can borrow large sums of money at very low interest rates. You can trace a line back to the point in when interest rates were higher many years ago, and we have, you know, the older generation say, well, in my day, interest rates were 10%. And it's like, yeah, and you know what? House prices were lower compared to wages. So the two things are directly related. And the other problem is the massive economic imbalance in this country, where everybody is trying to live in the same part of the country. Mm-hmm. That's where all the money is, or the same parts of the country where all the money is. And then there are other parts of the country where people don't want to live. And until we address that issue, the only solution that we're going to be able to come up with is, what is the solution? We just keep expanding London until it hits Milton Keynes. To be honest, I think that's a terrible idea, you know, but that is where that heads to. We need to spread the wealth and spread the earning and spread the entrepreneurialness, spread it around the country a little bit more, rather than everything being so southeast focused and then maybe some other small pockets.
But all of that stuff you said takes a little bit of time, should we say, a little bit of investment, a little bit of lateral thinking. In that regard, then, do we just take the white paper and chuck it out the window? Because there's nothing that you can put in a policy document that will solve the issues, Rachel, that Simon's just said there.
That is the problem, is having completely slated this report, I would quite like to be able to say, these are the few things in the next 5 years which be able to help the property market. But most of it, I think, involves stopping or rowing back on the types of policies that we have that are only proving to inflate the property market, push it further and further out of people's reach. And I don't even know that that is something that I would want, because it involves a property crash, which no one really wants. And a lot of our wealth, and also our sense of wealth, which is as important, comes from the notion of the value of the one asset that people have that they think is going up and up in value. And the Bank of England did a really interesting paper a few months ago. They managed to kind of extract people's ideas, notions around their wealth and the value of their property, and showed that people who own their properties, when they're going up in value, they spend more money. Mm-hmm. So it's not just about the housing market, it's about the whole economy.
So there's too many vested interests.
It's got too big. It's the ultimate too big to fail. We can't go back on it now.
Well, I did promise right at the start, so I hope you don't mind, Rachel, we would break it down and about how the white paper would impact four distinct groups that I mentioned. So would be downsizers. And we've heard a lot of noise about this, haven't we? But the actual word itself didn't appear once in the white paper. Did it any policies relating to would be downsizers?
No, you're right. There was a lot of kind of curtain raisers saying that there'd be things for downsizers. And that the paper did acknowledge that there were barriers to people who wanted to move out of the family homes in which they lived for decades. And they said that they were, quote, committed to exploring these issues further.
Oh, great.
So, no, nothing concrete at all. Just an acknowledgement that, yes, it's probably something that they should do. The one thing they could do is cut back stamp duty. But it's quite a politically sensitive issue. But these people who have had huge gains in their wealth from their house prices to then say that we're going to give you a bit of a discount on stamp duty, but you first-time buyers who are struggling, not for you.
Well, that is one of the problems, of course, is that house prices are also being driven up by the lack of people moving home. Mm-hmm. So there is the shortage of homes issue going on, but there's actually also the shortage of people just moving home. And if more people were moving home, you would probably find that there was a more liquid market. And generally, in a more liquid market, prices tend to be more kind of efficient.
Yeah.
And in a liquid market, prices don't tend to be very efficient. They can be skewed upwards. So if you cut back on stamp duty and you cut back on the cost of moving home, then yes, that would probably make a difference. Another thing that was, to be fair, was kind of like kicked around before George Osborne's last budget, and it sort of leaked out in the morning, and everyone was like, surely he's not going to do that, that's going to be a tough sell. And he didn't do it. Was cutting capital gains tax, right? So if you're a buy-to-let landlord, you incur capital gains tax at either 18% or 28%.
Just remind us, capital gains tax?
Capital gains tax is the tax that you pay on the profit you've made on the property. And realistically, if you've made a sizable profit, you're paying 28% tax, because it's added, in one of the weird tricks of the tax system, it's added to your income to then decide your capital gains tax rate.
Listen back to previous episodes for Charlotte Simon's rather long-winded explanation of that one.
But anyway, the idea was that you might cut this, and it would encourage people who had made large sums of money on their properties to sell up, cash in. And he did cut capital gains tax, but only for everything that wasn't residential property. So you only pay it on second homes, right? You don't pay it on your own home. And actually cutting it on for landlords, although it would have looked like giving landlords a tax break, and it was giving landlords a tax break, would actually be quite a good idea, because you would probably find that you would get lots of people, especially now with the tax crackdown that's coming in terms of mortgages and things like that, who would go, this isn't worth the hassle anymore. I've basically made 50 grand, 80 grand, 100 grand on this property. I'm going to cash in. And if you gave people that little tax incentive that said, actually, and you can claim more of your money, they'd probably sell those properties and you get more properties onto the market. So there is stuff that you could do around tinkering with the tax rate to try and get more properties onto the market. And, you know, you would find that if the landlords sold those properties, maybe it's less likely that landlords would buy them now because the cost of getting in and buying them is more expensive because of the extra stamp duty. And so you might find more first-time buyers buy them. I mean, you might not. You might just end up giving landlords a tax break. But to be perfectly honest, we've tried so many completely daft things that we might as well try something like that. And the other thing I'd say is we need to just kind of leave the property market alone as well, I think, you know, from a man who just advocated doing something to change it. But we've done so much tinkering with this, we should just leave it to correct itself in a way, because what will eventually happen is that house prices get so high, you know, and people can't afford the properties anymore because we're not bunging them interest-free cash to buy them, that people will just stop trying to buy in certain places and they'll start trying to buy in other places, and eventually the market should theoretically disperse. But the problem is we've got a massively rigged market at the moment.
It's all right, though, Simon, with the government's plans to start thinking about having more plans and then thinking about those plans, we probably will end up not doing a vast amount anyway. Rachel?
We're fighting also against people's need to have their own home. It's something that seems to be inbuilt to our psyche.
What? A house? And as a home?
I know.
Surely it's just only an investment. Surely.
And as such, there just seem to be all sorts of ways around rising prices. So the one that we see at the moment are the extension on mortgage terms from 25 years used to be standard, and now people quite happily taking out 30, which means, I mean, indebted forever. And also it costs a lot more money because you're paying interest for longer. So brokers, mortgage providers, borrowers, there will be a multitude of different ways around higher prices until eventually we reach that point of saturation where people say, that's it, can't do it, and they buy somewhere else or they don't buy at all.
Okay, we haven't finished yet. We've still got first-time buyers. Is there anything in there? Yeah. Oh, yeah, you've forgotten about that. It's fine. There wasn't a lot in for first-time buyers, but we'll stick with landlords then, unless there was anything that you noticed about first-time buyers that I seem to have missed. No, anything in there?
There's already lots for them.
So it
reiterated what it's doing.
Right.
You know, help to buy equity loans, ISAs, shared ownership, rent to buy, gave a little bit more detail on starter homes. This plan to let first-time buyers with an income of less than £80,000 or £90,000 in London buy a new build home with a 20% discount on the price. And the idea is that developers build these new build homes and then they sell them with a 20% discount.
But we knew this already, didn't we?
Yeah,
really?
We knew this
just
already. This
detail.
Was, I think, a David Cameron plan to sell people houses for 20% less, with, I think, presumably the taxpayer picking up the tab.
Yeah.
Which is a common theme that runs through many of these things where we help people buy a house, is really we're literally just throwing free money at the problem of expensive properties, except it's not free money because Muggins here and everyone else is actually ultimately picking up the tab for this one.
OK, so we're going to focus. I mean, you mentioned there are things that could happen for landlords. Simon Gerrard, the past president of the National Association of Estate Agents, has been speaking to you and he said, today's announcement shows the government is good at producing soundbites but not realistic solutions. It demonstrates a lack of understanding of the market and what is required to fix it. And landlords have been hammered quite a lot of late, haven't they, Simon? So did it continue thus?
No, actually, it's got some good stuff in there for the private rental market, to be perfectly honest. And there's something in there that some people have said, oh, they think that would be bad for landlords, but would actually be very good for landlords who think long term. And that is longer term tenancies.
Right.
So at the moment, most assured short hold tenancies are 6 or 12 months. And actually, a lot of people have contracts in their buy to let mortgage that says they can't offer a tenancy that isn't an assured short hold tenancy. So they can't go over the 12-month contract. Actually, people tend to rent places for longer than that. In fact, even in London, people tend to rent places for longer than that. They tend to stick around for longer than that. But what happens is you get the short contract, the rent hike, the short contract, the rent hike, the short contract, the rent hike, lack of security. Longer contracts would give tenants more security, but also landlords more security because they'll know over this 3-year period, my property is let and I will get X amount every month, and they can then do some good financial planning based on the income return that they're going to get from that property. And also they're encouraged to look after their tenants a little bit more, because rather than just yoinking one out every 6 months and yoinking a new one in and hopefully sticking a little bit extra on the rent, then they can look after the property. They can go, right, well, I know this person's going to be here for 3 years and I'll do these things to keep this person happy. And I think, you know, I've spent a lot of time writing about buy-to-let. My mum runs a lettings agency and has done for 25 years. And I know quite a bit about the market. And basically, the best thing that you can have if you want to be a successful buy-to-let landlord is happy tenants.
Absolutely. Yet, looking at some of the figures, and there's chew on the other foot now, Rachel, if that's all right, more than 4 million households privately rent, nearly twice as many as 10 years ago. The paper claims 28% of homes are non-decent, compared with 37% in 2010. Whoop-de-doo, we've managed to get that down a few percentage points. But non-decent, what does that mean?
It was a thing to do with a drive that was done by the Labour government, going back a long way, back Blair's government, decent homes standard.
So it's basically a load of rubbish, right? You're living in a home which is not good enough, in my book.
Just pull up the definition here. There's things that they had to do. They went round and they upgraded all of the council homes and stuff like that in order to try and bring them up to this standard. That was why there was an awful lot of work that went on like 10 years ago on them. So to meet the decent home standard, your council or housing association home must meet the HHSRS minimum safety standards for housing, be in a reasonable state of repair, have reasonably modern facilities and services, have efficient heating and effective insulation. How homes can fail the decent home standard: there are hazards in your home, such as persistent damp or a heating or electrical system that is in poor condition. Your bathroom has not been improved in the last 30 years. Mind you, there's a fair few home buyers who buy places like that. Rachel? The kitchen has an inadequate layout or not enough space. Hey, who thinks their kitchen's big enough? I want one of those massive islands in the middle of mine. It isn't warm because of an inefficient heating system or ineffective insulation.
Okay, bearing that in mind, Rachel, that's horrendous. 28% of people are living in that condition. So, you know, isn't that great that they can live there for 3 years now? Not really. Is there anything in this white paper that deals with them? Because in reality, are we not, with high house prices, going to get many more renters?
So, of course, the primary thing that the white paper does is acknowledges this situation.
Great. And have they got a plan to think about having a plan?
Yeah, and say we really must do something about the average couple who are tenants who spend roughly half of their salary on rent. It then went on to reiterate what Philip Hammond mentioned in his autumn statement, which was a banning of letting fees for tenants. And the white paper went further than this to say it would look into bringing forward that legislation.
Ooh, so but they'll look into it. Great.
They're
fantastic.
Looking into perhaps doing something sooner than they might have done. But not much more support beyond that.
Right. So in some, the white paper?
Yeah.
Meh.
No, this
average,
is...
Average. Below average.
Well, I feel bad slagging it off because I don't know what they should do in its place. But really, it's very little content.
Underwhelmed.
For 104 pages.
You know, one of the things that was suggested was, you know, and keeps being suggested, is this idea of building on some of the Greenbelt. But that obviously means going to war with you know, their own constituents ultimately, and the backlash that you get against that. And they've obviously decided that that's not worth them doing. I mean, I'm sure somewhere down the line we're going to find some kind of plan that involves eating into the Greenbelt. I just hope that when we do it in a far more sensible way than that you're seeing going on at the moment, because all the councils have been given these local plans that they have to draw up, not as part of this white paper, but they've already got local plans, and they've all been told you have to find X amount of housing. And a lot of what's going on is they then get consultants in who then produce an unbelievably long report that is very, very difficult to understand. And they come up with some very, very strange decisions. And it's happened in the town that my mum lives in Harpenden, where, you know, they came up with some plots of land and they've actually kind of recommended the one that seems to be the most sensible. But one that was a second choice is completely bizarre. It's about as far away from the town centre as you can possibly get. It's on an undulating fields. They've graded it as low quality agricultural land, when actually it's basically grazing land, you mm-hmm. know. But it is suspiciously not near any of the really, really expensive houses, and also just on the side of the largest council Ooh. Estate area from the sort of 50s in the town. And it just makes you question how these decisions are made, when there's actually probably a site that would be more suitable, but just happens to be next to the most expensive part of town. And this is going on in towns and cities around the whole of the UK. And if we are going to eventually come up with a plan to build on the Greenbelt, it needs to be a hell of a lot better than the one that we're coming up with now.
Pure coincidence, I'm sure, Simon. But the situation doesn't look like it'll get better anytime soon, white paper or no, with rents expected to go up the most, 25% in fact, according to the Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors, as taxes squeeze many landlords out of the market, forcing them to sell up.
This is all about a shortage of supply in both the UK lettings and sales sections of the market. And what we're expecting is a lot of smaller landlords, in fact, to look at exiting the market, given the landscape. It'll be a mixture of that, but also existing landlords narrowing their portfolios, taking less of a risk, having less properties as well. They'll be moved on into the owner-occupied section of the market.
Well, that was Head of Policy at RICS, Jeremy Blackburn there. In fact, experts reckon so rents will go up 25% over the next 5 years, house prices 20%. And on top of that, ex-Bank of England economist Professor David Miles has been warning that they'll continue this way for at least the next 50 years, with incomes failing to keep up with that. 50 years? Don't economists struggle with 1 year ahead? But never mind that. CEO of online estate agents eMove, Russell Quirk, is somewhat sceptical.
I do think the RICS here, we should take it with a little bit of a pinch of salt. I think the headlines here are sort of predicated around this being a little bit alarmist, where actually, look, if rents increase by, what we're talking about here is actually 3-4% per annum, that's not particularly scary. London, up until 2 years ago, was used to seeing certain parts of the town increase in terms of the sales market by up to 20% per annum. So if rents increase by 2-4% per annum, I don't think that's particularly unpalatable. The headline here is that rents will increase at a greater rate than property prices, but that's actually because property prices, not that they're falling, but actually the rate of incline is decreasing. So what we'll end up with over the next 5 years, I suspect, is house prices in terms of the purchase market increasing by about 2-3% and rents increasing by about 3-4%.
Rachel, 50 years? What's going on here?
Nah.
How can you tell? How can you make a prediction?
In 50 years' time, I'm going to phone up David Miles and tell him he's wrong. But, I mean, he's to be fair, his language was not all that committed. Talking about this price rise, he says, "I think it not implausible that this might be true."
I like that line as well.
There's so many double negatives, I don't know where we ended up by the end of the sentence. But yeah, by little, and you might end up seeing over 50 years of significant growth. But how? I don't see where people are going to find the money to pay for these inflated house prices. And while you can sort of draw lines on what's, you know, projections from what's been happening already into the future to predict roughly what might continue, house prices are weird. They don't follow cycles and straight lines. You know, so much of it is about sentiment. So it just takes something to happen, people to get a little bit freaked out. And we've seen it again and again. It's just we haven't seen it for a little while. But, you know, early 90s and the 80s as well, we saw the same thing. Suddenly people are like, hang on, that's really expensive. And then once a few people do it, it snowballs. So that's going to happen in the next, well, I think, considerably sooner than the next 50 years. But at some point, it always goes in cycles.
Eventually, there will come a point when we shake the magic money tree and we've shaken all the magic money off it, won't there? Unless we come up with some other kind of magic money tree to replace the original one. But what David Marles is talking about here is if you look at the long-term chart of house prices, actually, house prices didn't go anywhere for a very long time. And then in the sort of 70s, they kind of started going up quite substantially. And then in the 80s, they went up lots. And then in the 90s, and then it obviously fell, you know, in the post-80s, early 90s recession. And then they absolutely rocketed from about 1997 onwards. Then they fell a bit after 2007 and then went back up again. But you can divide that chart into two chunks. There's the original bit where they didn't really do much. And then there's the second bit, you know, the last 30 years to 40 years. And he said the big question is, can we expect the next 40 to 50 years to look like the last 30 to 40 house prices rising for a sustained period into the future? So he's saying, are we going to get the first bit of that chart where house prices didn't go anywhere, or the second bit where they went up a lot? And that's where he says it's not implausible, blah, 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 kind of thing. But there's a couple of key events that happened over the last sort of 30-year period that I think we need to look at. 40-year period. One is which house prices rose quite a bit in the 70s, but inflation was very high in the 70s. Okay, so house prices, although they were rising quite a bit, were only rising in line with inflation. Mm-hmm. You then had the deregulation of the mortgage market in the 1980s, which essentially was a major credit event because it suddenly meant that it wasn't just the building society, and you went into the building society and you sat down and you had a very long conversation with the building society manager and made a very long decision about whether to lend you some money. The banks started lending money and a lot more money was basically pumped in, and you had the start of the kind of the big start of the boom in the bond market, and it pumped a load of money into the property market, and that made it go up a lot again. Now, it then fell, but then post-1997, like what, especially once you get to 2000s, you had the credit boom, okay, where an astonishing credit boom through the 2000s to 2007 period, which we know was driven by mortgage-backed securities and a collective madness on a global scale that was going on. There was a point when I was working for This Is Money in 2006, 2005, 2006, when you could get a tracker mortgage that tracked below the base rate. Now, that's just stupid, right? That's just plain stupid. But nobody seemed to be concerned about it at the time. Then, of course, you had the aftermath of that, where house prices fell, but then they've gone back up again. But they've gone back up again because interest rates are currently at 0.25%. Mm. They are at a historic low. You can fix your mortgage for 5 years for below 2%. That's stupidly cheap. You can get a two-year fixed-rate mortgage below 1%. So you've got another major credit event. But my question would be, where is the next major credit event coming from that will drive house prices up again in that big straight line? Because I'm running out of imagination in terms of what I think we can possibly do to kickstart the market up again in that straight line. So I think actually it probably will tail off and go up by much less. I mean, and you might find actually that in 5 years' time, house prices are lower than they are now, because I reckon we've got about another 3 years left. And then we're probably going to have another slump. And so that will put us 2 years into the slump in 5 years' time.
Editor Solomon Lambert, personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss.
This is Money, in partnership with NS&I. Have any premium bond prizes you win paid directly into your bank account.
I'm Georgie Frost. In the studio with me is editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. To round up the week's top stories they've been covering on their award-winning website, This Is Money. So if buying or renting your home was tough, heating it is about to get a lot tougher as well. Who are we pointing the finger at today? Well, it is Npower, not satisfied with coming bottom among energy firms for the lowest level of customer satisfaction, not for the first, the second, the seventh year in a row last month, it's announced inflation-busting hikes to hit some 1.4 million people. Now, electricity prices will go up 15% on the 16th of March, while gas prices will rise 4.8%, which will add around £109 annually onto a typical dual-fuel bill. Now, the regulator wants Empower to justify the changes. Will others follow suit? Well, we're just hearing British Gas, one of the UK's big six energy suppliers, says it's freezing gas and electricity prices until August. Said it was able to hold tariffs in the face of higher wholesale prices by reducing its internal costs. However, Scottish Power said it's raising its dual fuel prices by an average of 7.8%. Now, they're blaming smart meters and low carbon energy costs for the rise. Rachel, what do you make of all of this?
It's a complete farce, actually. You've got the energy suppliers, or some of them, saying we have to put up prices because of all these costs, which are not our fault. They're out of our control. They're government imposed and all this sort of thing. And then you have the regulator who just tuts very loudly and says, we think this is unacceptable and we would like everyone to know how unacceptable it is. But what does the regulator do? Nothing.
No.
Nothing at
all. Well, it asks them to justify.
To justify.
Come into headmaster's office and tell us what you've done wrong.
Exactly. And yet again, the answer to all of this is us to go and shop round to make sure we get a better deal, which I'm not dismissing. Of course, that's what we should be doing. But it just seems like for every single situation, as consumers, where we're being ripped off, the answer is that we have to go and shop with our feet. That's not right, is it?
Vote with our feet.
Yeah,
either way.
Do that,
but then how do you do that when everybody else is raising their prices as well? Where do you go?
They're not. There are smaller suppliers who actually they are raising prices a little bit more, that, to be fair, because a lot of it is about when they buy their energy. So the reason that Ofgem says that the big suppliers shouldn't be putting up prices now is because they buy their energy way in advance. And yes, wholesale prices have actually gone up, but they say, look, you bought your energy a couple of years ago. Mm. So these additional costs, you're not yet incurring, so you shouldn't be passing them on to customers. Whereas the business model for smaller providers involves them buying energy not so far in advance. So they have, a lot of them have put up their prices, but still they are again and again at the top of the Best Buy tables where the larger suppliers are lagging.
Okay. Well, and meanwhile, Ofgem, though, did help some people this week. They announced a cap on prepayment meters, which could save up to 4 million households around £80 a year on their energy bills. Here's David Braithwaite from Citrus Financial.
It tends to be the more vulnerable people, people on the lower incomes, that have prepayment meters. What they're trying to do is to make sure that people save money, and it's trying to save money for those people who need it the most. So it's starting in April, and it'll mean for them around 10 to 15% of money they will save on their bills that they've got now. And it's just a shame it took 2 years to investigate this. And the problem also we have with the prepayment meters is because it's a much smaller market. So if you're paying your gas, electric by direct debit and you can shop around, which actually isn't as easy as it should be, that's another thing that needs to change. But if you have actually got a prepayment meter, the number of companies that go and will do that for you are quite limited. Therefore, there's little choice in that market for those people. And they are the people that need the choice to be able to shop around for the prices, perhaps more than the people that just pay the direct debit and don't think about it. And that's the problem.
OK, the cap's set to remain until 2020 when the government plans to have smart meters installed in every home. Simon, what do you make of this?
Well, two things. Firstly, it is very easy to switch your energy supplier. Go to thisismoney.co.uk/energy, where we have our tool that's powered by Energy Helpline. And whilst you and Rachel were talking just then, I just did it. I didn't actually switch, but I just compared my prices.
And?
Literally, it took that long. Well, it says that I could save about £300 a year compared to OVO, but that's with a lot of companies that I've never heard of.
Right.
And that's without me actually properly looking up my bills. But it probably would have only taken me 2 minutes longer to open up my emails, see how much I actually spend and put the actual figures in. So it is super, super quick.
Which highlights the point about the companies you've never heard of, though.
Yeah, it does. But we had an energy company that went bust at the end of last year, if you cast your mind back.
Yeah.
And there is a safety net that's been put in place, and the safety net worked. and those people were taken off to another supplier. You don't lose your power supply, don't worry, the lights won't go out. The TV won't go off in the middle of watching something.
Thank goodness.
You're not halfway through Midsummer Murders and all of a sudden the TV goes off while you're in your warm bath of homicide. But, you know, it is very simple and there's a lot of competition going on at the moment. As for the smart meters, well, two things on smart meters. I've got a smart meter. My energy company Ovo came round and fitted it for me. And there's two elements to it. There's the bit that sits outside that monitors my electricity and gas usage. And there's the bit that goes inside and lets me know how much electricity I'm using so I can try and switch things off to help me be greener. That bit's not working so well because it was basically on the side in the kitchen and it needed to be plugged in. And that's where we plug in the phones and stuff. So it's unplugged and in a cupboard. So I've kind of made my smart meter dumb. Because it's at the moment switched off in a cupboard where I can't see it.
Aww.
The other bit, though, is the bit that sends the information straight back to Ovo about how much energy I'm using. And I must say, that bit's ace. I can basically look up my bills effectively pretty much in real time. I go online, I log on to Ovo, and it tells me exactly how much I've spent. So no more energy company randomly guessing how much energy I'm using. And hello, energy company actually monitoring how much energy I'm using and pricing it properly. So I'm very pro smart meters on that basis.
Okay, well, I'm going to ask Rachel about prepayment meters shortly, but for clarity, I think I should mention there, Simon trying to make me crack up with laughter because of a previous episode in which Simon spoke about his love of Midsummer Murders. And I can't remember why on earth we were talking about that, Simon, but that's really how we roll, let's be honest. And I will play this clip at the end of the episode as well, just to remind you of the fact that even the most professional broadcasters just completely lose it when someone tells them the reason that they like a TV show is because, Simon, why?
Because it's like a warm bath of homicide.
You step into a warm bath of homicide, which we will leave right there because we didn't know where to take it the first time round. So thank you very much for Rich Browning who sent that through to us, your development, products and development, or what is his title?
Midsummer Murder Clip Editor.
There we go. I knew it was something important, but Rich sent it through to us earlier this week, so thank you very much for reminding us of that, Lee. It made me smile. Will this cap on prepayments meters, though, make people smile, Rachel?
I mean, it's a step in the right direction, isn't it? The treatment of people on prepayment meters, I think, is sometimes borderline pure wickedness. So often they are given to people, whether they want them or not, when they're in debt to their energy supplier. And their energy supplier will try to claw the debt back by every time you top up, you have to pay off a little bit of your debt. The problem is if you're in debt already, it's very hard to shop around. So it's not, you know, as Simon managed to do it in 2 minutes, if you are in debt to an energy supplier, it's a lot more hassle. And so what do? They just inflate the prices for those who pay prepayment meters. Also, there was a study a few months ago that said that not only that, but some suppliers charge you to put in these prepayment meters. So you are already in debt, yeah, and then they charge you again.
You have it, don't you?
I had one, yeah.
You got really annoyed.
I got really annoyed. I'm not even going into British Gas.
I didn't want to have a bad thought for you there. Just sorry about that.
But so it seems that the only way to stop energy suppliers ripping off the poorest, most vulnerable customers is to impose a completely anti sort of markets competition cap. And this is in place until 2020, at which point, hopefully, it should be fixed, as everything else will be fixed by smart meters.
Well, we shall see, shan't we? So amongst all the gloom and doom financial stories, we have some good news for motorists, at least. We're hearing car companies falling over themselves, they are, to offer us some really great deals to boost sales ahead of Brexit and changes to road tax. In fact, you could actually save up to 22% on the price of a new vehicle. And a chunky discount isn't the only incentive being offered for drivers thinking of an upgrade. The government is considering a scrappage scheme to get us to ditch our diesels. Yeah, after we were encouraged to get them in the first place by previous governments. So now, Simon, this has got your goat a little bit, hasn't it?
Yes.
Let's start with some positive, you know, just relax you a little bit. The 22% reduction on a price of a new vehicle, that's good news, isn't it? Were you unhappy about that as well?
No, that is good news. If you want a brand new car, then that's very good news. It apparently, a fear of stalling sales and a first decline in new vehicle registrations for 6 years has resulted in a bit of a discount war amongst car makers, who are willing to slash thousands of pounds off prices, which is very good news. And they're basically also a little bit worried that the new road tax rules, especially for cars over £40,000, are going to discourage people from buying new cars. And also, we're buying so many new cars at the moment that it is almost impossible for that line to continue going up. And obviously, they're concerned that that line is going to stop going up because they like to sell more cars. So that's good news.
Okay, that's good news.
If you want a new car.
If you want a new car. But, now for the bad news, Simon. Hit us with it.
Yes. So, the diesel scrappage scheme. Now, this is an idea that has been knocking around for some time. But last week, it raised its head again as something that we might possibly be on the way. So, where do I start? Do I start with the problem with diesels, or do I start with the problem with the scrap, or do I start with what a scrappage scheme is? Probably what's the scrappage scheme. Now, if you cast your mind back to after the sort of in the financial crisis slump, one of the first things that people stopped buying, other than houses, was cars. And this obviously posed a major problem for car makers. And we copied an idea, I believe, from the Germans, who also like selling cars, which was to encourage people to buy more cars. We would basically get people to scrap their old ones and give them a discount off a new one. So if you had a car that was older than 10 years old, you took it down and basically you needed to have owned it for at least a year to stop people trying to game the system. And you would get £2,000 off the price of a new car if you traded it in to be scrapped. And £1,000 came from the government. Well, from all of us. £1,000 came from the car maker. Now, there was a little bit of debate as to whether these discounts people were getting were real, as in, i.e., would you have got £1,500 off anyway if you'd done some negotiating? But this proved to be hugely popular. It took a large number of cars that were over 10 years old off the road and ended up with a large number of new cars being bought. So it was a roaring success in terms of selling more cars. Now, the other thing it was promoted as was green, because basically it took older, more polluting cars off the road and put newer, less polluting cars on the road. Now, one of the points that was widely made at the time was that basically the environmental cost of producing a new car outweighed the benefits of the slightly lower pollution from the new car versus the old car. So it wasn't really that green, especially because what you were encouraging people to do was scrap cars that were perfectly good and they had had no intention of scrapping previously and replace them with a brand new car. But diesels. The problem with diesels is they are lower CO2 emitting, so they're better for the planet. They melt less polar ice caps. They're nicer to polar bears, as Jeremy Clarkson would put it. However, they are also more poisonous for people. And we spent many years encouraging people to buy them because we were concerned about the CO2, and then wised up to the fact, unfortunately, that they were poisoning people, causing smog, and now we've got to come up with all kinds of ideas to deal with that. And one of the ideas to deal with that is having basically encouraged people into diesel cars through the tax system, we're now going to try and pay them to get out of diesel cars.
Right.
So we're going to get a new scrappage scheme. We're not definitely getting one, but the idea is we bring one in that gets people to scrap their old diesels and then they buy new cars.
Do they have to buy like a greener car or a hybrid or anything
Well,
like that?
Well, presumably the idea would be that we get them to buy a greener car. But the question is, what is a greener car? Like, we could get them to buy petrol cars, which are cleaner now than they used to be, but they still pollute.
And give it 5 years, they'll change their mind. And,
yeah, we could get them to buy a newer diesel car, which theoretically are less polluting. Mm. But the problem is, it's very difficult to actually measure the nitrogen oxide emissions of cars. As we discovered with VW,
car makers have been gaming
the system because the tests are done in lab conditions, not in real-world conditions. And in fact, there was a piece of research done recently that basically found that cars were actually pumping out more of this stuff than lorries. The reason being that cars in real-world conditions pump out tons more of it than they do in the lab, which is where they're tested, whereas lorries are actually tested in real-world conditions. So do we encourage people to buy electric cars? Well, maybe we do, but basically the infrastructure for charging electric cars is pretty woeful in this country.
Mm-hmm.
You've got some exceptions to the rule, like Tesla, who've put in their own superchargers, but basically I would be the prime market for an electric car, I live in the city, don't use the car so much, but like many people, I live in a flat. I don't have a drive. I've got nowhere to put an electric car charging point. And basically, the nearest point that you could charge that car is a bus ride away from my house. And you can't expect people to go park the car overnight and then get the bus back to their house. So, frankly, I think it's a dumb idea. Spending money on encouraging people out of cars into new cars, which could have more environmental cost. And yes, we need to do something about diesel, but a blunt idea like this is daft.
And breathe. Well done, Simon. Well done. And talking of breathing.
Hold your breath. Make a wish. Count to three. Come with me.
The adventures of Lee Charlie Bucket Voice continue as he left the This Is Money Towers with his satchel, his permission slip clutched in his sweaty palm, whistling a happy tune. Where did he head this week, I hear you ask? Could it possibly compare with the Royal Mint? Well, let's find out. We'll cross live over to This Is Money HQ. Lee couldn't be with us because he's already been allowed out once this week. Lee, Charlie Bucket Voice, a very good morning to you.
Morning, Georgie. This is quite an entrance for a story about going to a supermarket.
I built you up, haven't I? Okay, so you gave a little hint there. You've been to a supermarket.
Yes, I went to. I did a store visit at Aldi with a couple of their key people, and also went to the distribution centre in Chelmsford in Essex, which is where they sort of run the operations for all of London and the South East, about 100 stores. And it was as riveting as it sounds.
I'm glad I was going to have a word with the producer there. If it had just been you'd been out for your weekly shop, Lee.
Yeah.
But how did it compare to the Royal Mint then? Not very.
No, we can't make comparisons, Georgie. No. That's too difficult. But what I did do is learn a number of secrets. Because this week, Aldi actually became the fifth biggest supermarket in Britain, overtook the Co-op. So it must be doing something right. So that's why I went along to find out what it was that they are doing right.
And did you figure it out?
I think I did. You know what? I think a big part of it is the size of their stores and the layout. So most of their stores, I found out, are pretty much the exact same dimensions with the exact same store layout. So wherever you are in the country, if you pop into an Aldi, you're going to know exactly where everything is because it's probably going to be the same. And on that note, there's a much smaller choice of goods. So they only stock about 1,500 products, whereas some rivals stock up to 40,000 products. So when you go into an Aldi, you've got one choice of tomato ketchup rather than 20. So people can kind of go in there, do their shop, and they reckon the average shopper in there can do it in 27 minutes. Wow. Because of the way they've laid out their stores, which I thought was fascinating. And also some of the other things I learned while I was there, it's actually nicked some of the suppliers to some of the bigger supermarkets and the sort of more upmarket ones, which I'm not allowed to reveal who. Ooh. But that steak that you're buying at Aldi might be from exactly the same supplier as some of the bigger boys on the high streets. And they also get established brands that make some of their goods. So think of some of the cereals you see in Aldi. They're actually made by the proper brands, just with different packaging. So
The thing that really excites me, though, as well about your article is you've done a poll, and you guys like to do a poll. And it was, do you get Aldi and Lidl mixed up? I click yes. I'm in the minority there. 22% of your readers said yes, they get Aldi and Lidl mixed up. 78 say no. So are you sure you went to Aldi?
I don't believe this, Georgie. I'm pretty certain I went to Aldi.
Right.
But I thought everyone kind of got it mixed up. I thought that was one of the biggest problems.
I thought you might have posed that question, Lee. I thought you might have been yours.
I was in the yes category, and everyone I spoke to is in the yes category.
Yeah.
Maybe I read the smarter than we thought. But one of the ways it is different from Lidl, it tells me, is that nearly 8 in 10 of its products are sourced from British suppliers. So there we go. If you think that Aldi doesn't buy British, it does.
Fantastic. Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce, thank you so much for joining us. Editor Simon Lambert, Personal Finance Editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. Website and money section of the Mail Online. Customers, I'm sorry. A warm bath of homicide.
There's nothing wrong with a warm bath of homicide. You can relax.
I just completely lost it. We're talking about warm baths. Customers of the so-called Big Six energy suppliers could be playing